1534-W, Estate X. Rel. Fuentes versus the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, Robert Ruth representing the defendant, Mr. Fuentes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Robert Ruth. I do represent Jose de Jesus Fuentes in this matter, which is before the Court on a petition for writ of habeas corpus. The facts in this case are very simple. The Court of Appeals neglected to timely notify Mr. Fuentes' counsel, me, of its decision. It did not notify me, in fact, until after the 30-day time limit had expired. I asked the Court of Appeals for relief on behalf of Mr. Fuentes. The Court of Appeals regretted that it could not grant relief, but stated that, in fact, it could not grant relief because of this Court's prior rulings. At that point, I filed a petition for writ of habeas corpus, which we are here to decide today. I submit to the Court that this case presents two primary issues. The first issue I submit also is very easy to decide, and that is, should the Court grant relief? The second issue, perhaps more difficult, how should the Court grant relief? Now, it is appropriate that we have a full audience here today to listen to this case and an audience of high school students because so much of this case has to do with fundamental fairness. And I hope that everyone walks out of here today saying that at least Mr. Fuentes will receive fundamental fairness, and that is his day in court, his day before this court, his day to show this court that he should be entitled to have his petition heard, and that he should be entitled to have his appeal heard, and that in fact the appeal should be decided in his favor. Mr. Fuentes, of course, is serving a 40-year prison sentence, and he's serving that 40-year prison sentence right now without ever having the opportunity to be before this court, the opportunity that every single criminal defendant is entitled to have in this state.
Now, this may be not so much a legal question as a layperson's question. When his counsel withdrew, and of course the appellate court was aware of that, they mailed to that counsel, a result of their decision. It's kind of hard for me to appreciate the fact that that counsel would not then send it on to you. You were the new counsel. Apparently, and I don't know if that's in the record or not, the person just sat on that, did nothing?
Here's what happened, Your Honor. Quite frankly,
this is more a curiosity question than a real one, but I'm wondering what the heck happened.
Would have saved a lot of time and paper if it would have been forwarded on to me. My understanding of what happened, prior counsel left the private practice of law, and I think the record shows that. The record also shows that it was that her firm received a copy of the Court of Appeals decision. It was reviewed by a paralegal, not an attorney in the firm, and the paralegal just filed it away, assuming that I would have received a copy or that maybe perhaps Mr. Fuentes would receive a copy, but that never happened. The first time I heard about the decision was when I got the remitter notice, and that, I believe, was 33 days after the decision issued. Now, there are four reasons for granting relief, and that I submit are very elementary. First, without granting relief, Mr. Fuentes will be deprived of his right to effective assistance of counsel. Now, the hard part of deciding that issue has already been taken care of because you decided this case of Schmelzer. And in Schmelzer, this court said, yes, you have the right to counsel in a petition for review, and yes, you have the right to effective assistance of counsel in the petition for review. The court also said, if you're deprived of that right, and that was a late filing case, you might recall, if you're deprived of the right of effective assistance of counsel in your petition for review, your remedy is a petition for writ of habeas corpus in this court. And that's what we filed. So all the talk, the previous argument in the briefs about, well, perhaps this court is not in a position to grant relief, Mr. Fuentes should have sought relief from some other remedy, from some other source. It just doesn't add up because it's simply put, this court decided in Schmelzer that the proper remedy was a writ of habeas corpus in this court. Now, Schmelzer in this case are remarkably similar. The way this court described Schmelzer was the attorney agreed to file the petition, and then the attorney dropped the ball by failing to timely file the petition. Okay? In this case, I was the attorney. I didn't specifically agree to file a petition for review, but I never had a chance to even go into that with my client. When I accepted the appointment of this case, and when I filed my notice of appearance, I agreed to provide my client with competent representation. That was my agreement. So just as in Schmelzer, there was an agreement on the front end. And just as in Schmelzer, I dropped the ball. Now, I didn't drop the ball by any fault of my own. I dropped the ball because I never had a chance. Mr. Fuentes never had a chance to timely file his petition. So this case is similar to Schmelzer in that sense. There was an agreement on the front end. There was counsel, and the ball was dropped. Now,
I don't know if I would agree that you dropped the ball. I don't think you ever had the ball.
Well, maybe it's a semantics question. I don't think I made any mistake. I think I did everything that I could possibly do. The ball was dropped, though. The ball was dropped because I never got a copy of the decision within 30 days.
I mean, the reason I mentioned this is because perhaps that's a distinguishing feature. I mean, talking about dropping the ball makes it sound like the cases are the same. Maybe they are, but maybe they're different.
Your Honor?
Because of the factual distinction I point out.
They are the same. They are different, yes. But they are the same on the critical question of effective assistance of counsel. And that this whole talk about intentional failures, or my failure, or the court's failure, the bottom line to the right to counsel is so that the adversary process works. That's why counsel is there. I'm not here just to fill up a pair of shoes or to file paperwork. I'm here, and counsel is in every criminal case, to assure the adversary process. And when counsel is not provided a copy of the opinion, and counsel is not provided an opportunity to file a petition for review, it is impossible for the adversary process to work. And that is how they are similar. So why I didn't file the petition for review, why I wasn't given an opportunity to file a petition for review, whether the Court of Appeals intentionally or unintentionally deprived us of that opportunity, it doesn't matter. The bottom line is the adversary process broke down. Now, that dovetails... Yes, sir.
What would have been the result if your client had known, if witness had known, but you hadn't?
That would pose, I think, Your Honor, a very interesting question. Is the client responsible to notify the attorney? Now, I think that no. And this is based just on my experience representing criminal defendants. There's an assumption among clients that the attorney is aware of all of the procedural facts that the client is aware of. And oftentimes, clients are copied on items and no one ever calls me and they don't ever let me know that they were copied on it. Also, I would point out that Mr. Fuentes is incarcerated in prison. And he's not, although it's possible for him to contact me in writing, it's a difficult task. He's not a particularly literate with the written word. Also, he just can't call me whenever he feels like it. He's in prison. He only speaks Spanish, which makes it, now it is possible to communicate. I speak Spanish also, and that's how we communicate, but putting that together sometimes in the institution is difficult, and I can attest to that just in trying to set up telephone conferences with him. It's difficult for him to find someone who speaks Spanish to set up a telephone conference to have me call him. So that would be a different case perhaps for a different day, but probably the answer would be that even if the client is notified, it doesn't make any difference. That it all comes down to whether the attorney is notified, unless the client, of course, represents himself pro se.
Does the record show whether, in fact, he was notified?
It's, of course, the problem of proving a negative. Can you prove that he wasn't notified? I submit that, yes, the record shows he wasn't notified. The record is basically consists of my filings. The record, at least on this petition. And in this petition, I submitted the affidavit of the paralegal from the prior law firm, and that paralegal said that he didn't notify Mr. Fuentes. I didn't notify Mr. Fuentes because, of course, I didn't know. And the rest of it is who did the Court of Appeals notify? The Court of Appeals, who they notified is listed on the top of the decision, and Mr. Fuentes, the defendant, is not listed on the top of the decision. So I think from that, the only reasonable inference is that Mr. Fuentes was not notified.
Indeed, I think the Court of Appeals opinion in its text indicates that they did not notify him.
Oh, okay, that makes it even simpler. But, you know, the Court of Appeals accepts responsibility. I mean, they made that inference. That was an inference that they drew. They accept responsibility for failing to send the opinion. Yes, sir.
The Court of Appeals says that neither Attorney Ruth nor Fuentes learned of our decision. That's different from whether...
I think it takes it a step further. And I think they draw that inference from the filings that I made in the court, because I told them I didn't know about it. But the ineffective assistance of counsel argument dovetails very neatly with the due process argument. And because at some level, your right to effective assistance of counsel and due process become the same thing. And what we're talking about here is procedural due process. Again, a very fundamental element of procedural due process is that you have to have a fair chance to have your fair day in court.
Mr. Ruth,
yes.
The state objects to the petition for writ of habeas corpus on the basis that there's been no verification, at least at the time that it was filed with this court. Now, it's my understanding that you provided a verification later, about 18 or 19 days after the original filing. I've never heard of that happening before, a verification coming in 18 or 19 days or several days after. Is there any authority for doing that, anything that you can point to?
Well, it doesn't come up very often, Your Honor, and that's probably why there's no authority for it. I can tell you that if you go look at Schmelzer, there was no verification in Schmelzer either, and that's where I got the idea for all of this. The very minute that I saw that there was an objection to the verification, I typed one up, signed it, had it notarized, and got it right to the court. I submit that it really makes no difference. First of all, there are no factual disputes. And quite frankly, in opposing counsel's brief, they state that they are in agreement with our statement of facts. Also, the only case that I'm aware of in Wisconsin, which is a court of appeals case, that decided against a petitioner because of a lack of verification, did so because there were factual disputes. Okay. Also, in this case, and the Court of Appeals was careful in that case to say that, you know, we don't put too much emphasis, or we're not going to shoot someone out of the water just because they forget to cross a T or dot an I. And they did so in that case because there were material factual disputes, which we don't have in this case. Also, when you're deciding this question, the statute doesn't say when the verification must occur. It only says that the petition must be verified. Now, I submit that to read that statute in its plain meaning, the court should say, well, the verification must occur in time for us to utilize it. And 19 days after the petition was filed was long before the briefs were filed. And so if there are any disputes about facts, if there's any problem, there's plenty of opportunity for both sides to assert those disputes. None were asserted.
You could have just refiled the habeas.
I think I could have. I'm not 100% sure, but I think I could have.
Why couldn't you?
Well, in the Court of Appeals, there are cases that talk about subsequent filings of petitions for writ of habeas corpus, and that you only get one kick at the can.
I know, but if your kick is thrown out without prejudice because of a technical violation, I don't know that that fits. I mean, that's a general rule that this Court has observed, too, with post-conviction remedies, that you get one kick at the can. But if you never got that kick...
I think I could have refiled it. Yeah, I think I could have. And I tried to take care of it as quickly as I could have by filing the verification at that point in time.
Now, I'm looking at the Court of Appeals decision. It says the decision was not mailed to Attorney Ruth. Consequently, neither Attorney Ruth nor Fuentes learned of that decision until after remitted to it. It doesn't say it wasn't mailed to Ruth, but...
Or to Fuentes.
To Fuentes, I'm sorry. But I suppose that... we can just check that in the record of the Court of Appeals as to whether they generally mail to the defendant. You know if they do?
No, I believe they don't.
Okay.
I believe that they don't. But I think if you look at the decision, I laid this out in my motion to vacate and reissue in the Court of Appeals. If you look at the filing, they CC and they tell you who they're mailing it to and on their decision. And that didn't happen in this case. And I believe I have a statement from a clerk, the 4th District clerk, saying that that's who we mailed it to, whoever name is on there.
Well, I noticed that this very order from the Court of Appeals is addressed to Louis Charles, the trial judge, Mary Ellen Cross, Columbia County Courthouse Clerk, the District Attorney, the Assistant Attorney General, and you, not to the client.
There you go. Now that
and there's no CC. So...
That's with regard to the opinion of the court,
right.
Dated to
right.
So, A21.
Maybe they have different rules for different documents, but at least that one was not mailed. Okay. Now, what it says here, live on American TV, it says the Supreme Court stated the general rule is that after remitted up, the Supreme Court has no jurisdiction to vacate or modify its judgment. The sole exception noted in American TV is that a void judgment order may be vacated at any time. Do you view this as void?
Your Honor, I submit that that is a red herring. And I'm embarrassed to say that it's a red herring, partially because I let myself be drawn into it. This court has jurisdiction now by virtue of the petition for writ of habeas corpus. So that issue, the ought in American TV is only relevant to the question of vacating and reissuing. Okay.
Well, it was relevant, as they say, they being the Court of Appeals, as to the Court of Appeals authority. See, as I read this, it says Look, we don't have any authority here under your habeas, right?
No, see, I didn't file a habeas in the Court of Appeals.
You filed the motion for an order vacating.
Correct.
So they're saying we don't have any authority over your motion.
To grant that motion.
Right.
That motion was captioned in the criminal case.
Right. They don't have authority, they say, because, if I'm reading this right, now you correct me. They don't have authority because they've already sent that record back to the trial court. So they say they have lost all authority over the case to do anything because under the Wisconsin Supreme Court case, it says that the court has no jurisdiction to vacate or modify unless it's void. And this is not void, therefore no authority. I thought that that there was another exception, and that's what I'm getting at, which is error.
If it's inadvertence or fraud.
They don't quote that.
They don't. This has a lot to do with the remedy that you grant. It has very little to do with whether you should grant relief. But that will move me. Let me move to that issue. How are we going to fix this situation, this probably very rare situation of what happens when the Court of Appeals blows the time limit for the client? Now, there was a case, Edlund, the case that this court recently decided, was a trial court case. The trial court vacated and reissued the decision, and that was why I tried that in the Court of Appeals. I think the Court of Appeals is right. A trial court can do it because the trial court has different statutes, and the Court of Appeals cannot comfortably do it within the statutes, unless they want to say that it was remitted for inadvertence. Now, the question is, what does inadvertence mean in that situation? Probably it means, I think, in American TV and OP, this court meant by inadvertence in actually nailing out the remitter, not inadvertence in failing to notify counsel of the decision. I mean, the inadvertence that occurred in this case occurred about 33 days before the remitter went out. And so I think, in deciding, should we require defendants in this situation to file a petition for writ of habeas corpus, or should we allow the Court of Appeals to act on a motion to vacate the issue, you probably will have to modify the OP and American TV line of cases. You probably have to say, well, inadvertence also includes inadvertence in failing to notify counsel of the decision.
What's the issue then in this case? What's the main, forget the verification or the adequacy of the petition. What's the issue? How would you frame the issue?
Two very straightforward issues.
No, just give me one.
Well, how does the court grant relief? How should the court grant relief?
Yeah.
That's the most important issue.
So that's what I hear you saying now, contrary to your brief, in part. I hear you saying the issue is not... Let me just find your issue. Let me paraphrase it. That is, the issue is not whether the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court can restart the time to file a petition for review when the Court of Appeals fails to notify a criminal defendant of its adverse decision. That is, dealing with remittiture and being able to restart the time. That's not what you're asking for. You're asking for, it seems to me, the issue now is this defendant entitled to us granting the writ of habeas corpus?
Your Honor, I anticipated that question, and I think that when I state my issue and when I state my relief sought, I do so a bit inartfully. I think that it would be a good idea for this court to grant the Court of Appeals authority to vacate and reissue. And I think the court has the authority to do that. And I think the Court of Appeals suggested that they would like that authority in their decision, and quite frankly, the Attorney General, when I filed my original motion in the Court of Appeals, agreed with it. They agreed with that proposal. They agreed with the precise relief that I have requested back when I filed my motion to vacate. Okay? And so I craft the issue in that context because I think that's the best way to handle this case. But if you go to the relief sought section at paragraph 4, I also urge the court to either restart the time for Fuentes to file a petition or remand the matter to the Court of Appeals with instructions to do so. And what I'm attempting to do there is broaden it and say, well, listen, if you don't want to grant that specific relief, grant us some relief and grant us an opportunity, then you do it. Then you do it by our petition for writ of habeas corpus. Grant us the relief. Allow us to file the petition. But I think that the court is not going to be able to avoid the need to decide how should we deal with this in the future. And I think probably the least cumbersome, most efficient way to deal with it is to grant the Court of Appeals authority to fix its own mistake, to vacate and reissue.
Well, suppose we said we're going to grant you the habeas corpus because habeas is an equitable form of relief, and that where the record is clear that counsel did not receive the notice and had no opportunity to file a petition for review, that under those circumstances, the time for filing petition review was extended from blah to blah. What's the matter with that?
Well, that'd be fine with me. In the future, then, the question would remain, do you have to file a petition for writ of habeas corpus in the Supreme Court to get that relief? And I think that I would hope that the court would take the next step and say, how should we deal with this down the road?
Well, you can file a habeas corpus in the Court of Appeals, too, can't you?
I think you could.
Well, the statute says you can file a habeas in any court.
No question you can file a habeas. The question is, if it runs into some potential problems, maybe I'm overanalyzing this, but potential problems of where did the ineffectiveness occur? Because in State v. Knight, this court was careful to say that if it's ineffective assistance of appellate counsel in the Court of Appeals, you file your petition in the Court of Appeals.
Well, if that is, if you go the route of ineffective assistance of counsel, the three elements, as I recall, of habeas is that there's confinement. Number one, you've got that, the fellow's in prison. Number two, there's a recognizable error. Apparently, you might have that with the Court of Appeals opinion saying we made a mistake, we didn't send the notice right. And number three, there's no other adequate remedy. Under the case law, you can argue there's no other adequate remedy. Then you don't even get into ineffective assistance of counsel.
Well, you have to show that you were deprived of some right, though. And that would be, was he deprived of his right to effective assistance of counsel? Was he deprived of his right to due process? And if you did it in context of due process, yes. I think he could go straight to the Court of Appeals.
Well, and the due process would be that the statutes weren't followed.
Yeah, the court's internal operating procedures certainly weren't followed. Because the internal operating procedure says you must provide, the clerk provides a copy to counsel. So, yes. And that would be a due process violation. And so I think we got here on a petition for writ of habeas corpus because we filed a motion to vacate and reissue, and the Court of Appeals said they had no authority to act and essentially referred it to the Supreme Court. And if I had it to do over again, maybe I'd start with a petition for writ of habeas corpus in the Court of Appeals and just see what happens.
I'm not sure, and I don't know the answer to this, but just looking at the bench book, the judicial bench book, it says the modern view of habeas corpus is that it will redress constitutional as well as jurisdictional defects. Why do you have to get to a due process argument? Why can't you just say, you know, we've got a jurisdictional problem here and deal with it that way?
Well, it's a jurisdictional problem because of a constitutional violation. I
think it's a jurisdictional problem because they forgot to send a notice to the attorney, or they didn't send the right notice, and therefore jurisdiction can't be conferred.
Well, and a court could take the position that so what if you forgot to get your notice? That doesn't happen so often, and if it doesn't happen, if it only happens every once in a while, too bad for that particular defendant. And that's why we have to coin it in terms of a constitutional problem to say, well, you can't do that. Can't do that in this case, and you can't do it in any case. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Booth. Ms. Berkowitz, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin here, the Wisconsin Court of Appeals.
Thank you. May it please the court, I've just been introduced by Justice Abramson, and I appreciate that. I am Assistant Attorney General Monica Burkert-Brist, and I appear on behalf of the Attorney General representing the District 4 Court of Appeals in this proceeding. I have assumed representation of this case upon the retirement of Assistant Attorney General Jim McDermott, who wrote the respondent's brief in this matter. And I guess my appearance today is somewhat instructive to our class as not altogether unique, but hopefully infrequent situation of inheriting an oral argument after all the briefing is completed, and never having had an opportunity to work with anyone below on the case. At the outset, I would like to call the court's attention to a correction to our brief, which I filed by letter on Tuesday of this week. And that correction, quite honestly, is very important because it substantially changes the legal argument that was presented in the respondent's brief in this matter. It had to do with the mischaracterization of the Schmelzer case. And you're going to be in the somewhat also unusual position today of finding that counsel in substantial disagreement at this point appearing before you that relief in fact should be granted. And under the facts of the Schmelzer case, I think the Schmelzer case does give the court a potential roadmap and an ability to grant relief under the Schmelzer 2 decision. Having listened to the questions of the court of Mr. Ruth and his argument, rather than give you any kind of a formal presentation that I prepared, I'd like to go straight to the quick here and tell you some suggestions which I would have and our office would have for possible ways to remedy the situation. I think that the Court of Appeals was correct in holding that it did not have the authority and the jurisdiction any longer to do anything to vacate or modify its decision because remittiture had occurred. I believe that its legal interpretation of the standards set forth in Ott and American TV do in fact apply, unless this court wishes in issuing a decision on this case to carve out an exception.
Could I ask you, does the Court of Appeals have any inherent authority that goes with its being an institution to manage its own affairs and correct its own errors?
Well, it did not believe it had the same authority that this court, in an opinion written by Justice Bradley, indicated the circuit courts have under Chapter 806, which is the authority to vacate a decision on a variety of bases, under 806-701, I believe. And the court, the appeals, did not feel that it had that same broad authority under Chapter 808 and 809. One possible scenario would be for this court to look in the future through rulemaking or by carving an exception to American TV and Ott to provide the court with that similar type of authority, but the Court of Appeals did not believe it did. It might have been able to fix it before it went back down on remittiture, but it felt, and I believe correctly, that under the rule in American TV and in Ott, that it lacked complete jurisdiction to do that, unless the remittiture itself, and I think Mr. Ruth was correct in this, that unless the remittiture itself had been sent back through inadvertence, i.e. a clerical mistake, miscounting in the court's, you know, calendar to send it back too soon, or fraud.
Well, maybe it was inadvertent here by failing to notify Mr. Ruth. Therefore, it should not, its order or decision is not really in effect yet. Therefore, the timing for remittiture hadn't begun.
I think that's an arguable construction, Your Honor. I think the Court of Appeals was hesitant in light of both Ott and American TV and, frankly, the Schmelzer 1 and Schmelzer 2 decisions to sort of take that authority upon itself. In fact, you were discussing with Mr. Ruth the issue of whether or not a writ of habeas corpus wouldn't have been better filed at the Court of Appeals level, and I believe the Court of Appeals correctly noted that, or Schmelzer 1, frankly, pretty carefully told the Court of Appeals that it doesn't have the authority to extend the time period for filing a petition for review in the Supreme Court. Only this court has that authority.
That's the point I was going to raise with you. It's one thing for a court to deal with its own jurisdiction and own errors that affect its own behavior in its own filings. It's another question for a court to behave in a manner that affects somebody else's jurisdiction, like our jurisdiction for petition review.
And I think they felt that under the decision in Schmelzer 1 and Schmelzer 2 that, in fact, if the correct relief, and I would argue and submit that the correct relief would be to grant the writ and allow a 30-day period for Mr. Ruth to file a petition, if that were going to happen, it had to happen by this court's action, not by the Court of Appeals action.
Well, I gather from opposing counsel, but I think you ought to tell us, what is the state's position on what should happen when there is this kind of technical clerical error? I mean, we all agree it's an error, right? No intentional misconduct here, just a straight mistake was made, right?
Yes, that's correct, and that it was a mistake made by the court and not by counsel or any of the parties.
And I gather also, but maybe you should tell me, that ordinarily the criminal defendant does not get a copy of these orders and decisions. Is that correct?
That is my understanding, Your Honor. I don't think there's anything in this record that would indicate that the Court of Appeals procedure is to notify anybody other than counsel of record and the court.
Did you call the clerk of court's office and ask them that question?
I did not, because I frankly hadn't anticipated that it might be important to the court. But I can only speak from my personal experience, both in private practice and at the Office of the Attorney General, is that when decisions were issued, they were always sent to counsel of record, and then it was our responsibility to notify parties.
All right, so now we've got this error, clerical error. How does the state, what's the state's position on what should be done when such an error is made? And it happens infrequently, but it does happen. We have three cases, right? This is the fourth.
Yes, Your Honor. First of all, perhaps the best way to answer that is to say that the state has absolutely no objection to Mr. De Fuentes having a day in court in the sense of having a right to petition.
Right.
And in fact, Mr. Ruth is correct that our criminal appeals division did not object to even a vacation of the decision below by the Court of Appeals to give him that 30-day time period. So there's no question that we have no objection to him having an opportunity through one remedy or another to getting an opportunity to file a petition for this court's consideration. If what you are asking is how to go about doing that,
right,
what I would like to do is frankly give the court a couple of possible options, because I think that you're in a better position to ultimately pick which one you like better than I am to recommend a single one.
Okay.
The first is that I believe under your ruling in Schmelzer 2, you could simply fix this consistent with Schmelzer 2 by granting this particular writ of habeas corpus and using your jurisdiction under the writ to provide Mr. Ruth with 30 days to file on his client's behalf. The potential advantage to that option is you don't have to disturb any other case law. The Court of Appeals would be assuming that it was correct in its interpretation, that it once it remits a case, it has no jurisdiction to fix even a mistake. The downside to that, I suppose, is the possibility that you could be asked to rule on more writs in the future, in the infrequent but not totally unlikely event that this could occur again.
That really wouldn't take very much time if it's clear on the record that no notice was sent. Be automatic almost.
Yeah, I would defer to your judgment about how much time that takes the court, but it would seem to me that's a very simple way to resolve this if the court doesn't wish to go beyond the specific factual case-by-case analysis, which is what the writ situation would seem to require. The second option, and was one which was somewhat, I think, invited by the Court of Appeals' decision, was to give them some guidance about whether or not they do have any authority to fix their own problems. And if the court wishes to do that, I saw two possible avenues. One would be to potentially clarify the holding in American TV, which quoted from Ott directly, and just fix that language about inadvertence or fraud to apply not just to the fact of the remitter, the act of the remitter, but any inadvertence or fraud at the Court of Appeals level, allowing a court to vacate its decision on that basis. A third possible option, it was something I alluded to earlier, which is I presume the court could take a look at some point in rulemaking, giving the Court of Appeals the same type of ability to vacate and modify its decisions that the circuit courts have.
The circuit court went in under 806, was it? I'm sorry.
Yes, it did, in the Edlin case, and that was 806.07 sub 1.
Is that a statute or is that a rule?
That's a statute.
Well, it might be a
rule. I'm sorry, I may have misspoken.
806.
While they're looking, could you give me that second option again?
The second option would be to modify the court's ruling in the American TV case, which quoted from the old Ott decision, which would broaden the opportunity for the Court of Appeals when there's a mistake or an inadvertent error at some point other than the actual transmission of the remitter to be able to fix its own mistake.
I'm sorry, inadvertence, you're saying in the remitter, but the voidness couldn't have been in the remitter.
No, that's correct. But the language in American TV doesn't talk about void. It talks about inadvertence or fraud in the remitter rendering the decision void.
Say that again.
Yeah. What the American TV case says is that unless there has been inadvertence or fraud in the remitter, the court loses jurisdiction and has no ability to vacate a prior decision unless the decision itself is null, is void. And what the Court of Appeals said in this case was, well, our decision affirming Mr. De Fuentes' conviction is not void, and there was no inadvertence in the act or fraud in the actual transmittal of the remitter, so we don't fit within the American TV exception to be able to vacate our decision in this case.
We would have to broaden that finding in the American
I believe
TV.
You would need, yes, Justice Steinberg, I believe you would need to broaden your ruling in American TV as to under what circumstances would enable the court to vacate a decision after remitter has occurred.
Well, it's a Supreme Court rule, although there's a statute, too, so both have written in this. I mean, I'm just looking at the annotations. 806.07 is just the general provision on relief from an order or judgment by mistake, inadvertence, surprise, excusable regret, newly discovered evidence, etc. So here you would be asked for relief from a Court of Appeals decision on the grounds of clerical error of the Court of Appeals.
That's correct, and it frankly is very factually, the situation in this case is very factually analogous to the situation that this court faced in the Edlund decision at the circuit court level, which in that case the circuit judge issued his decision, there was an intention to mail it to the parties, and the clerk simply forgot to mail it. And as a result, none of the parties got notice, whereas in this case only one of the parties didn't get notice, but nobody got notice until after the 90-day appeal time of the Court of Appeals had expired. The problem is you don't have the same provision in 808 and 809 that you have in 806.
What do you do with the court? What do you do with my ear? What do you do with the Court of Appeals language in the Schmelzer case, which says, I guess on page 9 of the opinion, essentially that
they can't grant habeas corpus because they have supervisory jurisdiction over actions. They have no authority over the Supreme Court. Essentially, they're saying that. I can read that a bit more carefully, but. Although habeas corpus is an equitable doctrine which gives us authority to tailor an appropriate remedy, we lack authority to require the Supreme Court to accept for filing or consider the petition for review on the merits. We only have supervisory jurisdiction over actions and proceedings in the circuit court. Does that language have to be disturbed at all with your options that you're offering?
I believe you, Your Honor, is reading from Schmelzer 1.
That's what I meant, sorry.
And in Schmelzer 2, I believe the court made it very clear that this court has the authority to grant the writ.
In fact, that's one of the things.
So I don't think you do need to overturn or change that language because... Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's one of my concerns because the language in Schmelzer 2 apparently is very careful saying, this court, this court, this court. And Schmelzer 1 says, as a court of appeals, we don't think we can do it. And it seems to me that Schmelzer 2 is agreeing with that, or at least not contesting that by its emphasis on this court, this court, this court.
That's certainly how I read the two cases, which is that the court of appeals in Schmelzer 1 said, we don't, again, it may be that if the petition for review time period should be allowed to run longer because of, in that case, the attorney having dropped the ball.
Uh-huh.
This court agreed in Schmelzer 2, saying that, yes, this is the type of situation in which a writ of habeas corpus to this Supreme Court must be filed to ask for this court's consideration to extend that time period. I don't know that you need to disturb those decisions. You may wish to clarify that, in fact, that writ authority to extend the petition for review time period comes only here. I think Justice Abrahamson was referring to that earlier when she said that, yes, is an issue of jurisdiction. Does the Court of Appeals have the right to tell you that it can extend your jurisdiction? I think the answer to that is clearly no.
Well, but the trial court can, in effect, extend the Court of Appeals jurisdiction, but you're saying it's because there is already a rule in effect that allows them to do that.
Well, that's what I believe this court decided, Medland, yes.
And correctly so.
I certainly would agree. And I think the problem with the Court of Appeals was they didn't feel they had that same flexibility and power. The bottom line, Your Honor, is I'm not going to take time that I don't need to in order to make this argument. I think that it's quite clear that relief does need to be granted, and we're talking about a prisoner who's confined for a sentence of 40 years. This is not a matter which should be taken lightly, and our office has absolutely no objection to the court fashioning a remedy, and I hope I provided you with some possible options to do so.
I do have a follow-up question.
Yes.
Dealing with the Court of Appeals authority to issue habeas corpus and deal with this problem rather than our authority. As your opposing counsel notes, I think it is in their opinion, the Court of Appeals opinion, they have a footnote or something that says, you know, maybe we want to address this ourselves in the future.
Well, the Court of Appeals seems to be inviting you to giving them the opportunity to fix a problem like this on their own.
That's right.
They also, they sort of give it and take it away, frankly, the same breath of saying, be careful, please, and narrowly construe an exception because we don't want to be flooded either. And so I would ask, obviously, on their behalf that the court be mindful of that as well.
Is that another option, or is that one of your options that you've given us?
I think that would really be provided in either of the two options, the two latter options. I think if you just rule on the basis of Schmelzer 2 and grant this writ, you aren't giving them any further options. If you either change your American TV holding to broaden it a bit, I think that would give them the option to fix a future mistake of this nature. And obviously, if a rule were promulgated similar to the 806 provision for the Court of Appeals, then I think it would be quite clear that they could fix it.
Well, if we interpreted inadvertence, it seemed to me that you'd have to do it quite narrowly to cover just this kind of situation, at least at this moment.
I would tend to agree, yes.
Otherwise, we fit a big hole in limiting the time for people to petition for review.
I would certainly agree, yes. And I think the Court of Appeals noted that, which is why they somewhat qualified their footnote asking for assistance. I probably should just very briefly respond. There was a question I know about the verification of the petition, and I don't want to at least sit down without mentioning that I think under the circumstances that the verification issue should not prevent you from granting relief in this case for two reasons. One is that I do actually think our brief was correct in that I'm not sure that just a signature of counsel is adequate verification. On the other hand, I do think Mr. Ruth was correct on two bases. One is that the Meyer case, which he cited, the Court of Appeals case, makes it clear that this probably isn't an issue where there is no dispute of fact. So it really doesn't, it isn't a big issue in this particular case. And secondly, I do believe he properly cured it. And Justice Abrahamson, you're right, he simply could have refiled the writ. So there's no point in exalting form over substance in that type of situation.
Okay. Are there any, yes, Justice Brasser.
Could I throw out a hypothetical question to you? It seems that your opposing counsel is arguing that the only kind of notice that is adequate here is a letter in the mail. A letter in the mail conveying the brief. We are living in a different age. We have a traditional kind of publication like Wisconsin Opinions that publishes unpublished opinions of the Court of Appeals. And I think electronically we could have opinions all over the place that are issued that day. Now, is that just irrelevant to this matter?
Well, is Your Honor asking whether or not we should be considering if counsel, for example, was diligent enough in checking to see whether or not the opinion was issued through various other sources? I think that would, frankly, pose an undue burden on the attorney, since it's often very hard to guesstimate when a court of appeals may be issuing a decision on a matter. On the other hand, is it possible in the future that the court of appeals may decide to notify parties by a fashion other than the U.S. mail service? Certainly, if the courts decide to do that, and then it would seem to me that the issue of notice will be whether we may be back here on a writ sometime 20 years from now or 10 years from now in which someone's email didn't get through, and we have proof of that through inadvertence or error. I do think that since the court has a standard procedure for notifying counsel, and there's no question that the court knows counsel rely on that, that in this case where that procedure broke down and it was quite clear that the counsel for this petitioner didn't receive notice, that it would be unfair and I think unduly burdensome to expect attorneys to be able to figure out that a decision's been issued any other way.
Well, there could be an argument made that we really ought to send this down back to the Court of Appeals. And the issue isn't, did the Court of Appeals send the notice? The issue is, did counsel and or the client know? Now, the attorney could know from a number of reasons. Attorney could know because read it in the advance sheet. Attorney could know because read it in Wisconsin Opinions. Attorney could know because the attorney made a phone call to the clerk's office and found out about it, but never got the notice. So, if I understood the import of Justice Cross's question, that we ought not to look at the technical, did you receive it, but the substantive issue of did you know, which is a factual issue. The Court of Appeals may not be the place that would have to go because they don't have a technique for having a trial or a hearing. And maybe they'd have to appoint a referee or master, and I haven't looked into any of that in their power, so maybe they'd have to go to the Circuit Court for a hearing on when did you know?
Well, I do think in this case that the Court of Appeals did make a finding in their decision based upon the record they had that, in fact, counsel for Mr. De Fuentes learned, i.e. then knew, as of the date he got the notice of remitter. I mean, what clearly happened here is the decision was sent to the wrong attorney, but the remitter was sent to the right one. And, you know, unfortunately, at the point that the remitter, once Mr. Ruth got notice, it was too late. And I think the Court of Appeals is correct that it was too late, but I think this is hopefully a not too difficult problem to fix.
Yes, go
ahead. This is a homicide case, and it's not that I'm at all unsympathetic to the position that your opposing counsel is taking, but suppose the same facts occurred, but there had been a big story in the Wisconsin State Journal the morning after the opinion was issued that the appeal had been denied.
Well, then I think you're back in the territory, frankly, that Justice Abrahamson was referring to, which is if you ever have a writ on facts such as those, you may have to make a determination as to whether or not the parties did know and therefore had notice, such that the administration of justice doesn't require you to accept the writ. And at that point, you'd have to decide what body would be appropriate to engage in that kind of fact-finding. And hopefully, if we ever have that type of factual situation, the attorneys below will make a sufficient record for this court to make a ruling on those facts. I agree with you. It's a knotty problem. I think in this case, we don't have a factual problem as to when notice actually got to the petitioner and his attorney. But you could have a scenario like that that would be a high-profile case where notice may very well have been earlier.
Well, you write the opinion differently. If you write the opinion on a issue of did they get official court notice, then you write the opinion that way. There's no official court notice. That's it. They extend the time for petition for review. If you write the opinion that it's a question of when the attorney knew and what the attorney knew, that is a very different kind of opinion. And the question I would have, and I think that Justice Cross would have then, is which kind of opinion do you want? Which do you think is better for the administration of justice? An opinion that says
Hey, just look at the Court of Appeals record. Did they send it or didn't they? Or shall we look into the substance of did you know or didn't you know?
It would certainly seem to me that the Court of Appeals would prefer the simplest, clearest rule possible, which is going to be based upon what the court's record is. I mean, if in fact we're agreeing that the formal notice to parties comes from the Court of Appeals and upon mailing, that there's a presumption that there's receipt, obviously, but if there's a record in the Court of Appeals that it was sent to the right people, that that's what should govern, absent any type of strong showing of the contrary.
Even if the attorney knew.
Even if the attorney knew. And I think any other rule, quite honestly, gets back to what I was saying before about the burden you're putting on attorney staff to say, well, gosh, I didn't see it in the news, and I didn't see it in the... I didn't get an email, and I didn't read the unpublished opinions. You know, I mean, otherwise you're getting into all kinds of deep water that you probably don't want to be in.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Booth, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
One point that I would like to clear up, and I might have even misspoke, let me sort of explain exactly what the record shows in terms of the notice in this case. Here's the decision, and the decision does not indicate on it who received a copy of it. Okay?
It's just a decision.
Right. But I know I didn't receive a copy of it. 33 days, approximately 33 days after the decision issued, I received notice of remitter. That same day, I contacted the clerk and asked what's going on. And at that point, the clerk sent me a copy of the decision. So I received it. I received notice of it about 33 days later, and I received the decision the next day. At that point, I contacted the... Well, I filed a motion in the Court of Appeals, and in that motion, I assert that during the month of that the decision issued, I personally checked my P.O. box, my mailing address, each and every day, okay? And when I filed my notice of appearance in the Court of Appeals, I gave them my name and my P.O. box. Okay, so that's the only way that I can prove I didn't receive a copy of it, is that I checked my P.O. box each and every day, and it wasn't there. Now, I also contacted the post office and said, could it have been missed? Could you have lost it, or the dead letter box, or something like that? I filed, and attached to my motion is the formal inquiry I made at the post office. And I filed the motion, and I've not received yet a response from the post office, despite the fact that I've called them back 3 or 4 times. I don't know. Now, the Court of Appeals, and in my motion to the Court of Appeals, I said, I'm still waiting from the post office. I've waited about a month, but I have resolved to wait no longer. And I thought I'll file this motion, and if anything changes, I'll let you know. Well, nothing has changed. So, in the Court of Appeals, I think did the right thing. They said, well, maybe their record's showing. I don't know if their record's showing. But they did the right thing and said, well, it was our mistake.
It's my understanding, and I haven't checked for this case, that what happens is there's a... there's a mailing list for each case of the appropriate people. And then when that decision went out, if it works right, which it does generally, then either labels or addresses are made up of that mailing list, and that all of the materials relating to that case goes to a mailing list, and the mailing list is periodically revised to show changes of address, etc. I cannot explain, nor can apparently either one of you explain, why one mailing list has the right attorney and the other did not.
Well, and actually, I addressed that in my motion, Your Honor. I contacted the deputy clerk, and I asked about mailing lists, and it's explained in the motion that the deputy clerk explained to me that when one attorney is withdrawn and a new attorney files notice of appearance, the normal practice is to update the mailing list at that time, okay? The Court of Appeals granted prior counsel's motion to withdraw. I filed my notice of appearance in mid-January, okay? And I didn't get a copy of the decision, but when the remitter came down 33 days later, I was on that mailing list.
And it may have taken time, you think, to make the change on the mailing list, and that's why the error was made.
So the mailing list must have been updated at some point after the decision issued, but prior to my receipt.
That would be my understanding of how the system works.
And I've alleged that in the motion, which the Court of Appeals, I believe, accepted as true.
Well, I'm glad my understanding is probably correct.
Very well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That ends our hearing on State Ex-Rel Fuentes versus Wisconsin Court of Appeals. Now, we're running, just 1 minute, we're running a bit early. There is a second group from Lincoln High School that is going to be joining them for lunch. Is that right? Or no lunch, sorry. Era. Joining you for a discussion with Justice Wilcox, and what time were they told to come here? Noon. So, those of you who are here from Lincoln High School, what are you going to be doing for the next 10 minutes? You're going to sit here.
Well,
please. Okay, you're going to be joined by another group. All right, maybe Justice Wilcox would be happy to entertain you for 10 minutes. Okay.
I can sing and dance and talk, whatever you
want. Right, okay. So if you all will stay, Justice Wilcox will be right back.
Can I stay?